we present My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schran and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is John Julius Norwich.
Thank you. Our teams for this week are Dillis Powell, Antonio Fraser, Frank Muir, and Barry Took. First, a round of assorted phobias. What would you suppose you had a horror of or a strong aversion to if you were a sufferer from the following phobia? Frank, dromophobia.
Is it the unreasonable fear of Greek racetracks?
Unreasonable indeed. Well, you're not very, very far off, as in hippodrome you're thinking of.
I was thinking. Or unreasoning fear of Luton Airport.
I'll give you one mark, I think.
Thank
you've got
you,
the right
sir.
Sort of idea. Please, I like please. The idea of Luton Airport. It's actually the fear of crossing streets. It's the fear of terrible oncoming vehicles in all directions. Have a mark. Don't tap him too much. He's only got one. Antonia, iatrophobia.
Ah, well, years spent learning Greek, though I don't know half as much as Dillis, who I'm sure knows this. I know it's to do with doctors, isn't it? Iatros is a physician.
He is.
Well, it must be fear of doctors.
Fear of doctors, perfectly right. People faint when they get into a hospital, even before the treatment.
It's very interesting that both of the ones we've had so far, we all suffer from. Fear of crossing the road and fear of doctors. Fear of crossing the road to the doctors is even worse.
No, I love doctors. I'm an iatrophil.
You're an iatrophile, are you?
Yes, iatrophile.
I think I'm a dromophile. I quite like crossing roads. It brings out the metaphor.
Well, get on.
All right, I will. Dillis. Amaxophobia.
Well, now, in modern Greek, as I know only too well, amaxi means the car, which doesn't come. So, in modern Greek, one has always heard saying, then ichi to amaxi, the car has not come, and I'm about to miss the plane. So, amaxophobia is something to do with being afraid of driving or something in a car, a chariot. Riding in a chariot.
A car will do. You're perfectly right. It's a fear of cars. A fear of riding in cars. Too much. Bravo. Barry.
Yes.
Bellonophobia.
Well, fear of the telephone springs immediately to mind. It springs immediately back, of course.
Stuck?
Stuck.
No? Well, I'll tell you. It's a fear of sharp objects. It's a fear of pins and needles.
Oh, they're lying.
People who faint at the sight of a naked blade.
Oh, well, if you'd said that.
Well, no mark for that one, I'm afraid. Doesn't matter. On we go to the next round, which is a round of bits and pieces. Of precisely what are the following some of the component parts? Frank. A hackle, a maiden, a footman, and a mother of all.
Hackle, maiden,
footman, and a mother of all.
Mother of all. What? are they not constituents of the key scene of an early romantic novel? The mother of all finds her daughter, the maiden, in the arms of a footman, and her hackles rise. A maiden is a stick with a bit of wood on the end. Is it a roasting spit?
It's what you do with a stick with a bit of wool on the end. You've said
it.
I said wood. Oh, you said wood.
I meant wool, sir. It's the distaff.
It's a sort of a distaff, so they are all parts of a...
Oh, footman. Yeah, mother of all. It's a spinning wheel.
It's a spinning wheel.
I think...
I think actually I'd have given you 2 marks anyway for the short story, which you so cunningly wove. But now you've got spinning wheel as well, I'll give you 3.
Good.
Antonia, of what are the following component parts? A helix, a pinna, P-I-N-N-A, an anvil, and a labyrinth.
Is it anything to do with the Minotaur?
It's not actually to do with the Minotaur, no.
I think it relates to fear of questions. Appearing on quizzes and being afraid of the question, I think.
Maxitor.
Anvil.
They never turn up, Frank, that's the problem.
No, I don't think...
Do with surgery, do you think?
There's a certain form of surgical specialist who would instantaneously know the answer to these questions.
A bow...
Labyrinth. Can you remember? There is a sort of rather coiled up thing.
Intestine.
No, it's no, but I don't think you'll get it. I will tell you.
The ear.
The ear. They're all parts of the human ear. That's exactly what they are. The helix, the pinna, the anvil, and the labyrinth.
Yeah.
Well done. It is a close thing, but I think just in time you've got it.
Oh,
2 marks. Dillis. A scroll, a belly, a bridge, a neck, and a G-string.
Part of an instrument. A musical instrument.
Yes, you could say that.
Scroll, belly, a cello. Not a cello, smaller than a cello. It could be a cello, but it's a bit smaller. It's a bit miniature compared to the cello. or a bit sort of large. One or the other. It's a violin.
Why don't you take a great big chance on it?
A fiddle.
A fiddle. A violin, a fiddle is perfectly right. Cellos, I know, have scrolls, bellies, bridges and necks. I'm not absolutely certain whether they have a G-string. That was the only reason I couldn't give you the mark
of
the cello.
The air on the G-string is played on a cello.
Yeah, but perhaps not on a G-string on the cello. It may be transposed. Violins, I know, have G-strings, but do cellos. I don't know, but please don't write in and tell me. I can easily look it up in Grove when I get home. Barry.
Yes.
A first home, a second home, a third home, and a point.
A polygamist.
I think I cannot possibly withhold 2 marks for a polygamist. Not actually the answer that I have in front of me.
No. I'm sure it isn't. I mean, I was just hoping against hope that in the gap, somebody would give me the answer. And, is it a game that people play?
It's a game.
It's a game. It's an American game.
Not specifically, I don't think. I mean, it is played in this country as well.
Lacrosse, then.
Lacrosse is right. I gave you 2 marks, and then I've got to give you another one. Lacrosse. You've got 3 marks. 3 marks is what you've got. Now for a round of literary fashions. Can you quote or recite, or give the sense of, the lines that describe the clothes worn by the following fictional character? Gunga Din. What did he wear, Frank?
Very little.
Remember?
Very little.
Din jacket. Well, hardly anything, because it was hot. It was hot there. And he was the water carrier, so he didn't have room for a lot of clothes under the sash, under the strap that he carried the gourd in.
What we're actually asking for is a quotation.
What?
We're asking for a quotation.
Well, lad, I mean... I'm not sure that can help you there. To any extent. I think he wore uniform.
A uniform he wore?
Yes, right.
The uniform he wore...
was somewhat tall.
Better than yours.
I don't know this.
No.
Well, I'll be frank.
No, to be frank, which indeed you are. All right, I'll tell you. The uniform he wore was nothing much before and rather less than half of that behind. But anyway, you've got about the uniform. I'll give you a mark. Have a mark. We're going to be. Well done. Antonia. Robert Southey, or do I mean Southey, wrote about the devil in a poem which you doubtless recall. Can you remember how he described the devil's clothes?
Well, I doubtless recall it. But actually, there is a little doubt about whether I recall it or not. Heavens, I'm a hiss at my partner.
And I'll hiss back, but I don't think it will help a great deal. What did the devil wear?
Shall I tell you what the devil wore?
Borrowed trousers. Try borrowed trousers. That's always a good mark. 18th century.
Finery?
What?
Finery?
No finery. I'll tell you what he wore. His coat was red and his breeches were blue and there was a hole where his tail came through.
I think we ought to get a mark or a bit of a mark for trousers.
Well, it was his breeches. If you'd said his breeches, I would have given you. But you said trousers. No good. Actually, 18th century, breeches would have been much a better bet than trousers, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would have.
Yeah. Well, there it is. Dillies, can you describe the clothing worn by Miss Havisham?
Miss Havisham?
Yes.
She wore a very old wedding dress, but I can't remember how she described.
That's right. Can you expatiate on it a tiny bit?
It was a wedding dress which had been nearly burnt. No, I don't know how you describe it. It's covered in cobwebs. Yes, she'd been wearing it for years.
That's right. She'd been sitting alone in her room, hadn't she?
Yes.
Wearing it for years. She was, in fact, what Dickens actually says is that she was dressed in rich materials, satin and lace and silks, all of white. Her shoes were white, and she had a long white veil dependent from her hair, and she had bridal flowers in her hair, but her hair was white. Anyway, I give you a mark for knowing exactly what Miss Havisham looked like. Barry, the Pied Piper of Hamelin, can you remember what he looked like, what he was dressed in?
Half in yellow and half in red.
Half in yellow and half in red, yes.
That's what he wore, and his shoes turned up at the front and down at the back. And, yes, it's very good, but extremely long. You would like the whole poem or just a bit of it?
I'd just like a bit of it, I think.
Well, I don't know any.
You knew a bit. His queer, long coat from heel to head was half of yellow and half of red. That's what Robert Browning wrote, so it must be true.
Absolutely.
I think I cannot withhold two well-deserved marks.
Well, you are.
And now for a round of juvenile conundrums. If the difference between a prison warder and a jeweler is that one watches cells and the other sells watches, what is the difference between the following? Frank, what is the difference between a frisbee and the Prince of Wales?
Prince of Wales. One flies through the air, and the other
is air to fly. So near. You're halfway there.
One. Lord.
You're all right on the air.
Oh, one is heir to the throne, and the other is throne in the air.
Well done! Thank you. Antonia, what is the difference between a cat and a comma?
I've got it. It's claws and claws. I'm halfway there.
You're halfway there?
Yes.
Where are the claws?
On its...
paws.
Paws. Paws. One paws is the claws, and the other...
so near.
Oh, dear. Paws, I guess, right. I'm new at this game. Paws.
Can I tell you?
Yes, you'll have to.
One has claws at the end of its paws, and the other makes a pause at the end of its claws.
But I had all those words.
Yes. You did. You had all the words, and I will give you 1.5 marks.
That's very nice.
You just needed a little bit of help at the very, very end. Dillies, what is the difference, please, between a hurt child and a thundercloud?
A which child?
A hurt.
Hurt child.
Hurt child.
Mm-hmm.
And a thundercloud.
But how do we...
One roars with pain.
Pain and rain.
And the other?
Rains with...
Pours with rain.
One roars with pain, the other pours with rain. Quite right, quite right. Two marks. Thank you. Barry, this one I like very much. What is the difference between an angry impresario and Julius Caesar's barber?
Oh, I get all the goodies, don't I? An angry impresario and Caesar's barber. Caesar shaves the... Shaves the...
Shave.
Do we have shaving it here somewhere?
Angry.
Oh, I see. Yes, a raving showman and a shaving Roman.
That's right. A raving showman and a shaving Roman.
I mean, I got to a point I've forgotten whose question it was.
Stunningly well deserved.
And the audience helped us out there.
I think both of them are combined at present at the National Theatre, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Now, we have a round now which calls for verbal ingenuity. What I want you to do is to incorporate a given word into a very brief statement on a given topic. Frank.
How brief?
Very brief. At least the briefer the better. Can you include the word procrastinate in a statement about reinforced concrete?
Well, the trouble is the reinforced concrete is you pour in the concrete into a mould and it's wet cement and you bung the iron bars in and they sink to the bottom, rather like the egg in Grosvenor pie. But there's a secret, you see, that you bake the Grosvenor pie a bit beforehand until it's got a crust and then you thrust the egg in with your thumb and it doesn't drop to the bottom. Same with the concrete. You let it cure for a while until it's developed a crust and then you can push the reinforcing in. And that is done professionally, and the chap who does it is called a procrastinator.
4 marks. Antonia, can you include the word abracadabra in a statement about women's liberation?
It's easy. Once upon a time, a long time ago, there was a perfect world. It had nothing but women in it. There was no drink or cigarettes or anything. There were just women. And whenever they wanted to increase the race, they just said, abracadabra. But one day, one woman who was too clever by half said, I'm just bored with saying abracadabra. I've got a better method. And she outlined it. You know what it is. It's the one we use today. And so women will not be free until they go back to just saying abracadabra all over again.
5 marks. Dillis, kindly include the word idiosyncratic in a statement about cooking with garlic.
Idiosyncratic?
Idiosyncratic, yes.
Speaking as someone who was very nearly expelled from school for her dislike of the practice of cooking, indeed was detected riding her bicycle on the way to the beach to eat a halfpenny bun without currants. I regard the practice, the whole practice of cooking with anything as totally abhorrent, though I do enjoy the work of other people in that direction. But I regard the use of garlic in cooking as... Idiosyncratic, in that it deters the practice of embracing between the sexes.
Well done, very good. 4 marks.
It's very bad for abracadabra.
Barry, a brief statement, please, about intercontinental ballistic missiles, including the words Brigitte Bardot.
Well, thanks a bunch, as our friends say. Intercontinental ballistic missiles, as you know, have fins at one end and the members of another country at the other. And what people who have these ghastly things try to do is to not actually put any engines in them, so they don't really go in there, but they just build them, and they build them, they keep on building them, so that they always can go out to their electorate, those countries that do have electorates, and say, we have more than the other side. But on the other hand, they have more than us. And so this whole process of the intercontinental ballistic missile is an actual deterrent because they haven't got any motors in them at all. I say this to reassure you, world, if you're out there listening. And the whole point of this thing is that every country has their own version of them. I mean, some countries look at their ballistic missiles and say, abracadabra, nothing happens. Others have them made of reinforced concrete. That doesn't do a lot. Other countries don't make them at all, just procrastinate. Some of the Latin countries use garlic for their propulsion, and that doesn't work at all. But the French have used a brilliant method. They have one wonderful intercontinental ballistic missile. Whenever they're going to be really threatened, they're going to place Brigitte Bardot in it and tie her, to her toe a little slogan that says, make love, not war, and fire it. And if that doesn't get Brezhnev where he lives, nothing will.
Five splendid marks. Now for a question of identification. From the following biographical facts, can you identify the historical personage to whom they are pertinent or relevant? Frank. This particular figure, whom I have in mind, married a Miss Elizabeth Throgmorton. He's associated with the plant Batatus edulis, and he wrote the line, "Methought I saw the grave where Laura lay."
Batatus what?
Edulis. E-D-U-L-I-S.
Not chipped.
Not chipped.
Is Elizabeth Throgmorton Bessie Throgmorton? Is that a nasty way of obscuring?
He might well have called her Bessie.
But we call her Bessie, don't we?
You
do. Is that a nasty way of trying to pretend that Sir Walter Raleigh's wife was called Elizabeth when she was called Bessie?
Are you trying to tell me that the person I'm thinking of is Sir Walter Raleigh?
You're absolutely right.
So are you.
Too much.
Antonia, dear, as a child, he had a touching experience with Queen Anne. Customarily, he wore a brown coat with metal buttons, and he once remarked that grief was a species of idleness.
Well, in spite of the fact that Frank's jumping up and down, I'm not going to let him answer because I knew his one, and I wasn't allowed to say it. When he was touched, presumably, for the Queen's evil by Queen Anne, and it must be Dr. Johnson.
It was Dr. Johnson. You're perfectly right.
I always know. When Frank jumps about more than usual, it's always Dr. Johnson.
Sometimes there's another reason, but we'll let that pass. Dillis. He wrote a novel subtitled The Tale of the Revolution in Laurania. He owned a multiplicity of hats, and he painted a picture which he entitled Bottlescape. Who was he?
Multiplicity of hats. A novel about Urania.
Mm-hmm.
Churchill wore a lot of hats.
Churchill is right. Sir Winston Churchill is perfectly right. Bravo. 2 marks. Barry.
Yes.
He invented a wood-burning stove. He made the remark, remember that time is money, and once he had an electrifying experience in a thunderstorm.
Well, there you go. Do you want me to be quick or slow on this one? Because I'm
medium.
Well, medium to American. Well, he wasn't American, he was English. He was also a publisher and all kinds of things of that ilk.
Invented bifocals.
And invented bifocals.
He invented
absolutely everything, right? And he's been appears on stamps and on money and is in statues in the United States. It is Benjamin Franklin, I think.
Benjamin Franklin, you're perfectly right. Too much. A quick round now of homophones. Words that are spelt differently but have identical pronunciations. What such two words can be defined as follows. Frank, an unwelcome offshoot and humanitarian first aid.
A sport. A sport.
Support.
A sport, as in a rose. You have a sport.
A sport was in a rose.
A sport is a thing that comes up from beneath the ground and doesn't fly. And a support.
Is he having me on?
He's having you on.
I thought he was having me on.
I know him marked for it, but he's having you on.
He's I don't have to know about
sport. Sport. Why sucker?
Sucker. Sound the same. That's right. Perfectly right. An unwelcome offshoot is the sucker that you have to pull off
and
your rose, whatever it is.
And
first aid is sucker. Well done. Too much. Antonia. To interfere with and a form of decoration.
Medal.
Perfectly right. Medal. Too much. Dillis. To flax some cloth and politically to solicit.
Flax or cloth?
Yes.
Canvas.
Canvas! Yes, canvas. Barry, to stridulate.
To stridulate?
To stridulate. And a watery cul-de-sac.
Well, rub its back legs together, but you can't get that
well,
into one word.
Well, it makes a sort of noise.
Oh,
yes, what?
Creek
is right.
Creek.
Well done,
creek.
You've got it.
Creek.
Just
creek.
A chance. Just a little help from your friends, but nonetheless, I think I'll give you 1.5 marks.
Oh, you're very kind.
I am.
Thank
I
you
am. Much. Well, there it is, 1.5 marks, and I see, ladies and gentlemen, from the score, that it is a tie. And so now it's goodbye from Dillis Powell, Antonia Fraser, Frank Muir, and Barry Took.
In my word, the chairman was John Julius Norwich. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schrein. Thank you.